It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. This week, a look at Chinese cuisine from the southern part of the country. First, we're just 4 days out from Election Day, and both the presidential race and Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race are tightening. In addition to the flood of political ads you've been seeing this week, if you go online or watch TV or listen to commercial radio, candidates are making extra efforts to win over the Wisconsin electorate. Donald Trump's running mate Mike Pence will appear alongside Senator Ron Johnson and Speaker Paul Ryan. And Vice President Joe Biden is in Madison today in support of Hillary Clinton. And Tim Kaine and Bernie Sanders both appeared in the state earlier this week. Lily Gorin joins us now for more on the election countdown. She's professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Her published books include Women and the White House and Mad Men and Politics. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again today.
Let's look at this presidential race here in Wisconsin in particular. The latest Marquette poll shows Hillary Clinton with still a decent lead, 6 points. But we're seeing all these high-profile national surrogates and, in some cases, candidates themselves. So not everybody believes this is a done deal, do they?
No, I mean, I don't think that Wisconsin was ever necessarily a done deal. But the other thing to sort of consider as we look at some of the poll numbers, and the Marquette poll is a really good poll and it's consistently, you know, been pretty accurate, is that the polling all year has been a little bit less consistent. All polls have been, you know, they haven't shown a always clear trajectory. And so the campaigns also have internal polls that they don't make public to we, the public. And that may be indicating something to both campaigns. And so, you know, we probably are seeing responsible campaigns looking to, you know, try to make sure every last effort is made, particularly in some of these Midwestern states.
And I guess any state that is at all in contention is going to get a lot of attention because Donald Trump, for example, needs all the states he can get to have that pathway to 270 electoral votes.
That's correct. I mean, both candidates need the path to 270, and Trump's path seems to be a little bit narrower than Clinton's, but, you know, there are still lots of states that are not necessarily, quote, locked down, and Wisconsin is one of them.
Looking nationally for a moment, stepping outside of Wisconsin, we've seen what looked like a pretty solid lead for Hillary Clinton in a lot of national polls and a lot of key battleground state polls narrowing over the last week or so. That happened around the same time as the new FBI email announcements came out. Do you think that the poll changes are because of that kind of news, or is this maybe a case where the Republican voters, some of them who had doubts about Donald Trump, are starting to say, okay, still better than the alternative?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably a little bit more of the latter. I do think that there was some immediate response to the FBI letter and so forth, but I think a lot of what you're seeing, particularly in the, you know, the last waning days of the campaign, is the voters actually sort of, you know, if their partisan disposition is such, kind of coming home to their party. And I think in a certain sense, Trump's lack of, you know, sort of horrible press and you know, something like the Access Hollywood tape has, you know, sort of receded a little bit in the consciousness. And so his general sort of position in the media has been a little bit quieter. And so I think that's also allowing people who were sort of trying to figure out if they could bring themselves to vote for Trump, if they've sort of come home to him.
And I wanted to ask you about the candidates, the scandals that and problems that have plagued both candidates. On the one hand, you've got Donald Trump, and he had the Access Hollywood, the Gold Star family, taxes, things like that. A lot of different stuff. Each time it's a different thing. With Hillary Clinton, it's emails, and then that goes away, and then it's emails, then it goes away, then it's emails again. Does one type of thing hurt or help a candidate more than the other?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about when you have a scandal or an issue that, you know, sort of monopolizes or capitalizes on a narrative about you, the candidate, already. So there has been this kind of narrative around Hillary Clinton, whether it's accurate or not, with regards to her trustworthiness. And so then you have the sort of email issue, which is sort of leads into that narrative about whether or not she's trustworthy. And that tends to sort of you know, sort of make the scandal, whether there's anything to it or not, seem larger and to some degree, you know, sort of more relevant with Trump, because there's sort of a lot of these different issues, as you mentioned. One of the things that happens is it sort of leans into a narrative about Trump being erratic, or, you know, sort of not necessarily on script or ill-prepared, but it doesn't necessarily lean into one particular narrative beyond that.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at the latest in the home stretch to Election Day, presidential race, and Lily, the U.S. Senate race here in Wisconsin, going back to the last Marquette University Law School survey of this election season. A very narrow lead now for Russ Feingold. He's led in almost all polls up to now, but a one-point lead in the most recent one. And we're seeing a lot of money coming into the state for ads for both candidates now. Joe Biden attacked Ron Johnson in his appearance in Wisconsin today. So even the presidential surrogates are talking about our Senate race here in Wisconsin. What do you make of that race 4 days out?
Well, I mean, I think this is, I always anticipated that this race would be a very tight race. And I was sort of surprised earlier in the spring when there seemed to be a much wider margin by which Feingold was ahead. But this is, you know, this Senate race may be the difference between who's in the majority in the Senate. And it's also, of course, as you know, a repeat of the election in 2012 between exactly the same two candidates. And so we've also been seeing a lot of outside money coming into the state to buy advertisements, in part because some of the official party organs have sort of pulled some of their money out of the state. And so some of that is being filled in by a number of these other interest groups.
Not just the same candidates in this race, some of the same issues. One of the things that's come up lately again is the Affordable Care Act. It's 2010 all over again. With the news, high premium increases for the part of the Affordable Care Act that includes the health care exchanges. So this resurfaced all of a sudden as a big issue again.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's an interesting approach that Johnson is taking, because he, of course, is the sitting senator, but he's running ads as if he were the outsider against Russ Feingold being the sitting senator.
And Ron Johnson has nodded toward the idea of what some people have been calling pre-peachment. Some Republican U.S. Senate candidates saying they'd be open to considering impeachment charges against Hillary Clinton should she be elected, related to the email server. So what do you make of that, being out front about that even before Election Day?
Well, I think impeachment is something that should not be gently batted about. And so I'm not really sure what the charges of impeachment would be. And I, to some degree, am hesitant to enter into a, you know, debate about what Mr. Johnson is talking about until he provides, to some degree, more specifics on that.
Getting back to the Affordable Care Act, just a general trend I think we're seeing in this election. We saw some economic news come out today. A decent job growth, not great. Unemployment ticked down just a tiny bit. When you look at the Affordable Care Act, supporters can point toward successes expanding a lot of health care coverage. Critics can point toward failures in terms of those premium increases I mentioned. It seems like a lot of those fundamentals that could sway a race, if there's really good news or bad news, a lot of it is in the meh territory. So neither side can really claim a win there.
Yeah, and again, a lot of the critique of the Affordable Care Act was that it was going to be a job-killing sort of move or policy. And so if the unemployment rate is down below 5%, we're getting into the realm of what, you know, nationally would be considered almost full employment. And that's, you know, that's not to say people are in jobs they love. A lot of people are still displaced by the economic downturn in 2008. But when you start getting into 3%, 4% and 3% unemployment, there aren't that many jobs that people don't have at this point.
We're talking to Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. We're 4 days out from the election. We're talking about the most recent candidate visits to Wisconsin and more as we run up to elections. And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1017. 1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Have recent events in the news about either candidate influenced who you'll be voting for in the presidential race, in the Senate race? If you're undecided in either of those, are you any closer to making up your mind? What do you think about turnout? We'll talk about that in a minute. Expected to be in the neighborhood of 70% in Wisconsin. Have you turned out already? What do you make of early voting here in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. We are in the final days before the election. Candidates continuing to make appearances here in Wisconsin, presidential candidates, running mates, surrogates. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been seeing a lot of political ads lately? Has that affected your vote? Has it made you turn off the medium that you're watching? Do you have election fatigue? Are you looking forward to seeing this thing done no matter how it turns out? What are your thoughts on the race for the U.S. Senate here in Wisconsin in the race for president? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Lily, I mentioned election fatigue. There's been a lot of talk about voters feeling stressed by this election, sick of the coverage, and criticism of all the coverage and talk about the more scandal, seamy sides of things, the emails again, the Access Hollywood things. I wanted to get your thoughts on that because some people say, you know, we should be focusing on the issues and the platforms. Other people saying, these things give us the emails, Access Hollywood, and all that gives us insight about the candidate, their character, their decision making. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, it has been strangely of a presidential campaign, one that has not focused nearly as much on policy, even debating policy itself. You know, the ideas. You know, we know that Trump has talked about, you know, building a wall or deporting 11 million people. But there isn't a lot of particularities about how that's going to work. And so we understand that that's a campaign policy that he's been arguing for, but there isn't a lot that I know from, you know, what he's articulated on the campaign trail that's a lot more clearly articulated than that. And Clinton has, again, a number of policies that she has also articulated with regard to, you know, more access and forgiveness with regard to loans for college education, fixes with regard to the Obamacare and so forth. But there's been so much more about the individual as opposed to the policies themselves that it's hard to even know if you can list five policies that each candidate is arguing that they're going to try to implement. And when presidential candidates get elected and when senators or House members get elected, they do actually try to implement the policy that they talked about on the campaign trail. So people should probably pay attention to the policies, even if the candidates themselves aren't saying all that much about them.
Let's go to our callers now. Ben is on the line in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. I'm just wondering if there's anyone out there that kind of maybe has a similar approach. Well, I'm thinking of actually kind of splitting my vote congressionally with Johnson and perhaps with Hillary Clinton, partially because I'm somewhat libertarian-minded and I kind of enjoy the stalemate or the checks and balances. I get kind of concerned when either party gets too much power, and the more checks and balances, the less they can do, the less they can meddle. So that's kind of my take on things. So.
Ben, thanks a lot for the call. And Lily, Ben is not alone, at least in terms of the split ticket concept. People might come to it for different reasons than he does. How much are we expecting to see, you know, maybe somebody voting for Hillary Clinton and Ron Johnson, for example?
Well, again, I think that's part of what we have to wait for election night to see which way the Senate goes, if the Democrats pick up sufficient number of seats to be in the majority there, or is it going to end up being split 50-50? And I know that's something that Paul Ryan talked about on a phone call a couple of weeks ago, that there was also then some pushback about, that he's, you know, been really campaigning hard to maintain a Republican majority in the House again, and he's articulating it as a check on a potential President Clinton. And so I anticipate that there's going to be ticket splitting both in Wisconsin and in a number of other states. How that actually shakes out in terms of who wins, both at the top of the ticket and then lower down, again, remains to be seen.
Ben, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to David in Madison. David, hi.
Hi. Hi, thank you so much. Just a couple of quick notes on Obamacare. Remember when the Republicans said it would, they always used to say it was a job-killing Obamacare, but we've had 74 months in a row of job growth, about contiguous with the same time of the Affordable Care Act. But my main point is this. Yes, the premiums on the Affordable Care Act on the federal exchange are much higher. About 10% of the U.S. population gets its health insurance that way. About 60% through our crazy post-World War II system when we didn't raise prices during World War II. About 60% get their health care through their employer. About 30%, close to 30%, actually get government, straight government health care, either Medicare, Medicaid, or the VA. Medicare has about a 1.5% management cost, so it's a super efficient cost from the management end of it. But the Affordable Care Act only has about 10% of the people in the whole country are under that. And so those big premium increases are only going to those people. Other premiums are rising, but rising slower since the Affordable Care Act.
David, thanks a lot for the call. And Lily, the Republicans are definitely, Donald Trump in particular, jumping on that those premium increases. David saying it's a small number of people, but that's a significant increase if you are one of those people. So I don't know, where do you go with that?
It also varies from state to state.
Sure.
And so that's the average increase across the entire country. Some states are seeing as small increases, as I understand it, as 3 to 6%. Other states are seeing double-digit increases. And so that's varying state to state. But, you know, again, these are policy questions. And so to ask both Trump and Clinton, you know, what are you going to do in terms of either fixing Obamacare, which is one of the things that Hillary Clinton has articulated, talking about trying to sort of adjust some of the issues that have come up since the legislation was enacted, and Trump, who has articulated essentially getting rid of it and replacing it with something else, but I'm not exactly sure exactly what that something else is.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the author of books including Women and the White House and Mad Men and Politics. Let's talk a little bit about those women and the White House, Lily. Actually, women voters. A lot of people watching different demographic groups of women and how they are going to vote or not in this election. What are you watching for?
Well, I'm looking at that really closely because that may be the difference between the election of Hillary Clinton and the election of Donald Trump. And there are some real interesting numbers that came out today with regard to sort of some of the differences. In Wisconsin, some of the numbers I saw is Hillary Clinton is carrying women 55% to 34%. And so you have over a 20% difference in terms of the number of women who are voting for her versus the ones who are voting for Donald Trump. And that's not necessarily an anomaly. And that may be, you know, again, it may be the largest gender split that we have seen in presidential races. And I don't know, again, it will be interesting to see how that works also down the ballot for other races as well.
Let's go back to our callers now with Ross on the line in La Crosse. Ross, hi.
Hi there. I'd just like to say from a student's point of view, everyone at this point in time, whether they're voting for Hillary, Trump, anyone else, they pretty much had their mind made up at this point with the election coming up in 5 days. And I just wanted to give my two cents there because based on the illegalities for both sides, we've had a lot of controversy back and forth, and I think everyone's got their mind made up from a student's point of view.
Ross, thanks a lot for the call. So, Lily, Ross saying whatever comes out now, people are pretty much locked in. Is that generally true for most people?
Well, you know, and we have already over 30 million people across the United States who have voted. So they are, in fact, locked in. And that's probably maybe a third of the electorate, maybe a little bit less than that at this point, who has already early voted. Now, some states don't have early voting. But again, you have a sizable chunk of the electorate that has come out in places like Wisconsin and Florida and Georgia, and has already voted. So they've made up their mind. People made up their mind a couple weeks ago, maybe months ago even. And as soon as they had the opportunity, they just, you know, they took the opportunity to vote, and they're not, they may not be thinking about the election anymore.
Thanks for that call, Ross. We'll go next to Will in Green Bay. Will, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I just wanted to comment quick. I mean, we're bringing up all these issues of women's rights, you know, who's going to vote for who, when both parties have completely disregarded all types of demographics. And the only real option here that I'm feeling is third-party choice, whether that be Jill Stein or Gary Johnson. But the demographics should be switching to a third party this election.
Will, thanks for that call. And Lily, earlier on in the election, people were looking at the high negative ratings for both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and saying, maybe this is the year we're going to see big votes for third parties. Gary Johnson was polling pretty well for a while. He is not lately. What happened? Third parties, people don't seem to be going that way right now.
Well, third parties, it's really hard to sort of operate successfully as a third party at the presidential level, in part because states also have different ballot access laws, and so some states you can get onto the ballot a lot easier than you can in other states. And we actually have another third party candidate beyond Gary Johnson and Jill Stein who have ballot access in I think all of 50 states, Evan McMullen out in Utah, and in some of the other Rocky Mountain West states is on the ballot there. He's not on the ballot in all 50 states, but he's actually running quite competitively in Utah. And his numbers are stronger in Utah than Gary Johnson's are in most of the other states in the country. And so what you do see in third party opportunities is somebody who is, you know, maybe voted Democratic or Republican for a very long time, if they see a viable third party candidate and they want to vote for that person and they do actually vote for that person, they may be more likely in the next election cycle to also vote for a different party, a third party possibly.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the author of Women in the White House and editor of Mad Men in Politics. Talked to us about the latest efforts from candidates to sway Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, it is Food Friday. Our guest chef shares recipes and cooking methods from what she calls the culinary heart of China. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's our weekly check of the top state news stories with Robert Menser from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. First, when it comes to eating Chinese food, you might be familiar with Sichuan or Cantonese cuisines, as they tend to be the more popular options here in the United States. Less familiar are the flavors from a region south of China's Yangtze River known as Jiangnan. And that's where you'll find some of the best food available in the country, our next guest says. In a new book, she describes the food and cuisine by saying, quote, "I know of no other that can put one's heart so much at ease." Today on Food Friday, we'll dig into this unique style of Chinese cuisine, the ingredients that go into it, and how to make it at home. Fuchsia Dunlop joins us now. She's a chef who's won numerous James Beard Awards. Her new book is Land of Fish and Rice, Recipes from the Culinary Heart of China. Fuchsia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi.
Well, you've traveled extensively through China. You've focused on this particular region, Jiangnan. Am I saying that right?
Jiangnan, yes.
So tell us a little bit about how you fell in love with this region's cuisine.
Well, I started traveling to Shanghai, which is the best known city in the region, about sort of 15 years ago. And then I kept sort of returning to other parts of the region. I just kind of fell in love with it. And it was something about, you know, the beautiful landscape in places like Hangzhou, which is known for its West Lake, and this exquisite food. They have a kind of reverence for ingredients there and a way of cooking very gentle food that just makes you feel so relaxed and healthy.
What are some of the flavors we'd find in this kind of cuisine?
Well, one of the best known styles of cooking there is red braising, Hongshao, and that's where you use soy sauce and rice wine and sugar to create these rich and opulent gravies. So things like red braised pork is a very well known Shanghainese dish, or Dongpo pork from Hangzhou, which is named after a Song Dynasty poet called Su Dongpo. That's one style. And there are also drunken dishes made with Shaoxing rice wine, so that have this lovely sort of aromatic fragrance. And then there are lots of dishes which are really about the ingredients. So the kind of values that we think of as sort of modern Californian cooking, and this idea that you want to eat really gorgeous seasonal vegetables and really, you know, excellently sourced meat and fish and so on. And these kind of ingredients, you don't want to sort of cover them in strong seasonings. You want to sort of bring out their natural tastes. So a lot of the cooking here is very fresh and natural, and you use small amounts of things like stock and ginger, scallion or green onion, dried shrimps, maybe a little salt pork or ham, just to magnify those beautiful savory tastes.
And it looks like it isn't about one overpowering flavor in a dish, a really hot dish or a particular seasoning that jumps out. It seems like it's a lot about a balance between the flavors.
It is. It's about a sort of harmonious balancing of flavors, which is not at all to suggest that it's dull, because like any good Chinese meal, a meal in the Jiangnan region has to have a variety to thrill the palate, you know, with some stronger taste, some milder taste, refreshing soups. But it is about a harmonious mixing, and it's food that I like to think of Sichuanese is the jazz of the Chinese cooking world with all those kind of electrifying flavors. The food of Jiangnan is like its classical music. So it's very beautiful and sort of harmonious, but it's in a completely different register.
It sounds like that should be complicated to pull off, but looking at a lot of the recipes, a lot of it is, I don't know if I'd say simple, but it's not so complicated that I, for example, wouldn't even touch the recipe.
No, not at all, because you have to remember that, I mean, apart from the fancy food in expensive restaurants, you know, the people of Jiangnan cook at home, and people want to make dishes that are quick and easy and, you know, not overcomplicated. And so I just love the farmhouse cooking and home cooking of this region. So many of the recipes in the book just have a few ingredients and really pretty straightforward to prepare.
We're talking with Fuchsia Dunlop. She's the author of the book Land of Fish and Rice, Recipes from the Culinary Heart of China. Let's get into some recipes now. You shared a couple from the book. We've got these linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's start with soupy Chinese cabbage with salt pork. And this is one, this is not a huge ingredient list. This is one I feel like I could pull off at home. Can you talk us through this recipe a little?
Yeah, well, that's the recipe, and this is very typical of the Jiangnan region, because they often do what they call xian xian he yi, creating a unity of fresh and salted ingredients. So they use some strongly flavored salt-cured or pickled ingredient with something fresh. In this case, you've got the salt pork and you've got the Chinese cabbage. And what happens is that you have a very light and healthy vegetable, in this case the Chinese cabbage, but you have the richness and deliciousness of the salt pork. And so it's a very simple dish, but the cabbage becomes lovely and silky and ribbony, and you get that rich, savory flavor. So I think with this style of cooking, you can kind of have your cake and eat it. You know, you can eat very healthily, but you have the kind of richness of sort of less healthy, meaty dishes.
Yeah, this is using that pork, or you say you can use unsmoked bacon or pancetta in there. This is using it as a spice, really, a flavor, not as big chunks of meat in the dish.
Yeah, a lot of recipes, I mean, in this region and in Chinese home cooking in general, meat is used more as a flavoring principle than the main deal. So it's actually very economical and very healthy and very kind of sustainable. So I think, you know, for people who want to eat more healthily but still want to enjoy their food, it offers real solutions to the sort of problem of how to eat more healthily but still really feel satisfied by your food.
Now, one thing that surprised me a lot looking through the book is you mentioned at a couple points, pumpkin is a big ingredient in this region. And we've got a lot of pumpkins out here in Wisconsin that we can cook with right now. Talk about what they do in this province with their pumpkins.
Well, there's one recipe that I really love. I mean, I know Americans really love pumpkin pie, and this is a sweet dish from this region, which is also made with pumpkin. So you can steam your pumpkin till it's really tender, and then mash it up and add some glutinous rice flour, which you can get in any Chinese supermarket, and you make a kind of dough like that. And then you make it into balls, which you stuff with red bean paste. Is a very easy sweet stuffing to find, but you could use other kind of sweet stuffing. You make it into balls, and then you deep fry them. And so you get this lovely, sweet, squidgy, bright orange pumpkin dough with the sweet center, a very delectable sort of dessert dish.
I'm looking at the recipe for these pumpkin cakes. They look amazing. And then there's also a pumpkin bit in the beverage section, pumpkin juice, in a way, a pumpkin smoothie with honey. People drink their pumpkin there.
Yes. Well, they don't have, yeah. I mean,
not just in pumpkin spice lattes, I should say.
Yeah, this is from a recipe from the Dragonwell Manor, a wonderful restaurant in Hangzhou. And there they always have seasonal fruit or vegetable juices. And here you steam your pumpkin and then you blend it until it's like a kind of milkshake consistency and sweeten it with honey to taste. And it's so silky. It's like kind of drinking a sunset.
That sounds fantastic. We're talking right now with Fuchsia Dunlop, author of the new book, Land of Fish and Rice, Recipes from the Culinary Heart of China. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced the cuisine of southern China? Are you from there? Is this part of your family heritage? You can join us at 800-642-1234. And if you need some cooking advice on making Chinese food of various sorts at home, let us know that. Let us know your go-to recipes as well. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You can find a couple recipes while you're there. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment. Maybe hear from you here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about Chinese cooking with Fuchsia Dunlop, author of the new book, Land of Fish and Rice, Recipes from the Culinary Heart of China. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make homemade Chinese food? Is this maybe part of your family heritage, or have you tried to recreate something that you had while traveling, maybe at a restaurant? What questions do you have about cooking particular dishes, working with particular ingredients? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post and get a couple recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. And Fuchsia, big picture, I think when we think of Chinese food here in the United States, an image of Chinese American food at restaurants pops up. What do you think about it? China, obviously a huge country with lots of people. There's a lot of diversity in the food styles there, I imagine.
Oh, it's totally amazing. And really, you know, the kind of Chinese food that you get in America, even now when you can see more regional cuisines than just Cantonese in recent years, you still only see the tip of the iceberg. Because China, as you said, it's a huge country, and it's a country where food has been so important for hundreds or even thousands of years. So every region has its own flavors, its own special ingredients, and its own speciality dishes.
And you wrote a piece recently on 10 tips for cooking with a wok. Now, is this a region where the wok is a key tool?
Yeah, I mean, the wok is a key tool all over China. Okay. It's really one of the most important pans in implements in the Chinese kitchen.
Let's go to a caller now. We've got Mark on the line in Minneapolis. Mark, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Mark?
Yeah, so it's my first time cooking dinner for my family, doing a big old Thanksgiving dinner. And I kind of want to try just a new entree, kind of come at it, you know, instead of just doing the traditional, kind of want to come at it from a different angle. So any ideas for just some out there entrees, either Asian or otherwise, that would be a crowd pleaser?
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. I have counter-programmed Thanksgiving sometimes with my famous Thanksgiving enchiladas. Fuchsia, anything from the new book that would make a good entree or maybe alternate entree on a Thanksgiving table here in the U.S.?
Well, there's one dish which is a real showstopper. I haven't tried it with turkey, but it's the beggar's chicken from Hangzhou. A wonderful dish. You get a whole chicken and you marinate it, and then you stuff it with sort of stir-fried pork and pickles and leek. And then you surround it, traditionally actually, with clay. But I suggest that you can do it with a salt crust pastry. So you first of all, you wrap the marinated stuffed chicken in lotus leaves, which you can get from good Chinese supermarkets. Then you wrap it in pastry and you roast it, first at a high temperature and then at a low temperature. And then when you're ready to eat, you bring it out to table and you offer one of your guests a mallet to smash open the pastry. And inside is this absolutely gorgeous bird, soft and juicy, with the wonderful aroma of the lotus leaves.
Mark, that's a savory showstopper for sure. Give it a try. Send us a picture of the pre and post malleting of that chicken. Let's take a call now from Josh in Kenosha. Josh, hi.
Hi. I was curious. I'm not really too familiar with Chinese food. Is there a good traditional Chinese dish that would be good, a good starter for like someone like me who has more and a more American palate? And I'll
just
put the question out
there. There are lots of dishes that will suit you very well. There's one dish in my new book, which is the stir-fried chicken with ginger, which is a sort of very simple and very satisfying stir-fry, nothing alarming about it. The lovely fragrance of ginger, sort of very juicy, succulent chicken. So that's a recipe that will teach you some of the basic techniques of stir-frying, not intimidating and with a very delicious result.
Josh, good luck with that. Thanks for that call. We are talking to Fuchsia Dunlop about her new book, Land of Fish and Rice, Recipes from the Culinary Heart of China. Want to get into another recipe that you've shared with us, Fuchsia. We've got this also up on the Central Time Facebook page. I flipped to another one. Oh, here it is. Shanghai noodles with dried shrimp and spring onion oil. Tell us about that one.
Well, that's one of my absolute favorite go-to recipes when I want to have a quick lunch at home. Very, very simple with just a few ingredients. So you need to buy some dried shrimps, which you can get from any Chinese supermarket, and soak them in hot water with a dash of rice wine. When they're nice and plump, then you're ready to go. Then you take a whole lot of scallion, spring onion, green onion, whatever you call them, and you chop them into lengths. And then you fry them in oil, maybe peanut oil or canola or something like that, in a neutral oil. And you fry them until the spring onions are really, really aromatic and going quite brown, and then you put the shrimps in and you fry them for a bit too, and then you end up you've got this oil with the brown spring onions and shrimp, and then you just pour that off. When you're ready to have your noodles, all you have to do is put a little soy sauce in a serving bowl, add some cooked noodles cooked to your liking, and then add some of this oil with the crunchy bits of shrimp and spring onion, and then mix it all together. And it sounds so minimal, and it is minimal, it's very easy, but it's fantastically delicious. And the great thing about this recipe, which is what I do, is that you can make it in larger quantities and have a jar of this aromatic oil, and then it takes literally 5 or 10 minutes to make a delicious noodle dish for you and your family.
This sounds like it's comfort food, maybe for you in particular.
Oh, yeah.
And is this something that, you make it for yourself, is this something that you've served for large numbers of people as well? Is it a crowd pleaser?
I've served it to family and friends, and I've also served it at cooking demonstrations and larger events because it's easy and it's surprising and it's delicious.
Are there particular kinds of noodles that are common with this type of cooking?
Well, yeah, I mean, in Shanghai, they would tend to use a sort of a fresh wheat noodle. So the ingredients would just be sort of wheat flour and water. And they sometimes add a little of a sort of alkaline ingredient, which makes them go a bit yellowish and makes the texture a bit more springy. But actually, honestly, I also sometimes make it at home with dried udon noodles, the Japanese ones, or, I mean, I guess you could even try doing it with spaghetti, which would probably be also very delicious.
It seems like there's, looking at a lot of the recipes, it seems like there'd be some pretty easy substitutions that you could get away with in a lot of these.
Yeah, well, some of them, you know, it's like a principle of the recipe. So like when you cook some kind of green vegetable with some dried shrimp or a little ham or pork or something, that you can take that idea, and if you've got a different sort of cabbagey green or whatever, then you can just substitute it in. And in some recipes, I do make suggestions for other substitutions that are very easy to do.
Now, we mentioned those pumpkin cakes earlier. Any other ideas for a good dessert item?
Well, there's a very unusual, I mean, not unusual in China, but maybe unusual to American palates, a lovely sweet soup with little glutinous rice balls in it, with a sort of black sesame stuffing. So that's something very typical of this region, and not as sweet as some American desserts, but with this lovely sort of huggy texture and very kind of refreshing.
Are you going to be getting back to this region for more inspiration anytime soon?
I'm always going back. I can't keep away. I just love it.
What's your latest discovery there as we wrap up, food-wise?
Oh, well, I mean, I was there a couple of months ago, and I had this amazing dish of little fresh river crabs, and it was in a very nice restaurant, and they'd stir-fried the legs with a bit of soy sauce and rice wine and sugar, and they'd also stir-fried the crab meat with ginger and served it in the shell, and it was absolutely exquisite. It's perfectly in season, these little crabs. so nice.
Fuchsia, thanks so much for joining us and sharing all these great inspirations.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was chef and cookbook author Fuchsia Dunlop. Her new book is called Land of Fish and Rice, Recipes from the Culinary Heart of China. We've got links to two of her recipes, soupy Chinese cabbage with salt pork. I think I might try making that one, as well as Shanghai noodles with dried shrimp and spring onion oil. We've got those posted over at the Central Time Facebook page. Terrorist acts by ISIS, fears over national security, and fiery political rhetoric have thrust American Muslims into the spotlight of the 2016 presidential campaign. Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Danielle Kading followed a Muslim family in Superior for a day to see what life is like for them during this campaign season.
How are you doing? You made it.
Yeah. How's your morning going?
It's going.
Ibrahim Al-Kuda, Abe to his friends, doesn't track the campaigns that closely. In fact, he didn't watch the last presidential debate. As a father of four, he's more worried about getting the kids to school on time, studying for school, and keeping on top of the invoices he reviews as a civil engineer for the city of Superior. In a word, he's busy.
I got zero sleep sometimes. Not always, and not frequently, but a lot of times, 4 to 6 hours. That's not bad, I guess. I don't know. With four kids and all of this stuff, it's not bad.
The night before, Al-Kuda was installing flooring into the early morning hours at a house he recently bought.
I was working on staining the cabinets. There's the basement that needs to be waterproofed, and that is really a big project.
He receives a text from a visiting friend to let him know he'll be at the mosque for Juma, or Friday prayer. Besides homework and school, Al-Kuda is also the president of the Islamic Center of the Twin Ports. He leads prayers every Friday afternoon, so he heads home early to get ready with the rest of his family.
Hello. We're supposed to be there at 1:30. We are always fashionably late.
That's Al-Kuda's wife, Beth. She's going to school for nursing while taking care of their four kids. She worries about them during this presidential election, especially when Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump came to Superior this past spring.
My daughter is in middle school. I was a little nervous. She wears a scarf, so she's very noticeably Muslim. And I was worried that somebody would maybe say something to her or kind of single her out.
Beth Al-Kuda already sees her son, Laith, who's just 5, shying away from anything that identifies them as followers of Islam.
I don't know if he sees it as Muslim or Arab or different or what it is, but he definitely understands the concept already that he should fit in to what everybody else's concept is.
As the president of the Islamic Center, Abe leads the prayers since smaller communities don't have an imam or Muslim leader. He says some people seem to have a generalized view of Muslims.
Typically, when you say this, people picture somebody who doesn't like the country, who is a terrorist, who could just harm other people, etc. But that's not the truth.
Beth says they're just like any other religious family in America.
We go through phases where we're like, oh, we're really good. We pray 5 times a day. Sometimes we're like the Catholics who only go to Christmas Mass, you know.
But the fear of a religious test or registry when Trump called for
a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States
is a big reason why they're voting for Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. But even Clinton has drawn flack from some Muslims for saying,
we need American Muslims to be part of our eyes and ears on our front lines.
Some say Clinton's rhetoric reinforces Americans' association of Muslims with national security concerns. Like many parents, Abe Al-Kuda says they just want a better future for their children.
That they don't have to spend so much work and time and energy and stress over this really nonsense when they could just pursue their dreams and just do whatever they want to do in this life and be happy.
So Muslims like them can have their shot at the American dream. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find all of the WPR News Team's election coverage at wisconsinvote.org. And here on Wisconsin Public Radio, we'll have a lot of coverage still to come between now and Election Day and beyond. Join us Sunday afternoon at 2 for the right to vote, from freed slaves and women's suffrage to today's debates over voter ID and felon enfranchisement. We trace the wild history of the right to vote in America and explore one of the most basic questions facing our democracy: who may participate? That's The Right to Vote, Sunday afternoon at 2, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Also join us election night Tuesday. We will have live coverage of the elections with analysis and results as they come in. We'll be bringing you state-focused coverage of the state legislative races, congressional districts, U.S. Senate race, and the presidential vote in Wisconsin. And we'll be hearing from NPR with their coverage of the nationwide race for Congress and that whole presidential thing going on, too. That's election night here on the Ideas Network. It's time to switch our clocks again this weekend. We fall back Sunday morning at 2. Make sure you wake up and switch the clocks from 2 to 1 as we mark the end of daylight savings time. Or maybe you can just do it in the morning. I'll leave that up to you. This means that we get one free bonus hour, so use it wisely, make the most of it. I'm thinking a little extra sleep. It'll get lighter earlier, so no more pitch dark walks to school for the kids, but it will get very dark very soon into our shift here on Central Time. A brief survey of our Central Time producers finds that 2 out of 3 have an active dislike for the practice of changing the clocks. One of the other one didn't seem to feel too strongly at all. I don't know what the thinking was. They don't like that it's going to get dark earlier, though that's actually the normal time. It's summer that's been the weird time to get us that extra hour of daylight at the end of the day, if I understand it correctly. If you're out at the bars, if you're in a band playing in a show, as I used to do, you get to play for one extra hour as the clocks switch, just as the bar would usually be closing in most parts of Wisconsin. That was, I don't know, good and bad. It was fun to play longer. I don't know that anybody needed to hear us that much longer. Well, again, remember to change those clocks, and a lot of people recommend changing your smoke alarm batteries and carbon monoxide detector batteries at the same time. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time.